From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
In 1969, Curt Flood, the starting center fielder on a very successful St. Louis Cardinals team, was traded to the Philadelphia Phillies. While thousands of men younger than Flood were chanting, "Hell no, we won't go," with reference to Vietnam, Flood quietly wrote Commissioner Bowie Kuhn a letter indicating that he wouldn't go to Philadelphia. According to Alex Belt, the author of a new book about Curt Flood, the two phenomena were not entirely unrelated. Flood had experienced Jim Crow segregation, and he'd grown up in the civil rights movement. He regarded his challenge to baseball's reserve clause as the necessary act of a man determined to stand up for his rights. Alex Belt, who writes for SportsIllustrated.com, admires Flood, and he wrote Stepping Up, subtitled The Story of Curt Flood and His Fight for Baseball Players' Rights, in part to address the extent to which Flood has been forgotten. When we spoke, I asked Alex Belt to begin by describing the circumstances Flood and his contemporaries were in while baseball's reserve clause was still operating.
40 years ago this spring, Marvin Miller took over as the executive director of the Players Union. And in the late 1960s, there was the beginnings of players becoming really conscious of how unfair the system the reserve system was. But in 1969, when Flood was traded, baseball players from the biggest superstars to the lowest scrubs essentially had no rights. The reserve clause bound them to the organization that they played for forever. And so this was the situation Curt Flood found himself in when he was traded after 12 years of service with the Cardinals.
Flood was not the first player to challenge the reserve clause, but nobody had tried it for a couple of decades before 1969. Why not?
Well, I think part of the reason was because that in a team sport like baseball, there was a real anxiety about stepping up against the establishment, and players rightfully feared for their careers if they were to do such a thing. And the two players that had challenged baseball's antitrust exemption previously were really minor players. And Flood really was notable as being the most prominent player ever to challenge the reserve clause. And really, the reason no one else had done it could be bore out in the results of the Flood case. He got hammered. He lost his case, and he lost his livelihood and future in baseball.
The logic behind the original Supreme Court decision establishing the reserve clause as legitimate contended that baseball was not a business engaged in interstate commerce. How did the Supreme Court arrive at that conclusion?
Well, it was it's believed to be a largely sentimental decision. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was obviously a very esteemed and venerated Supreme Court justice, passed this decision, and it was in 1922, and he did say baseball was a business, just that it didn't, the laws of other businesses did not apply to it. So I think very shortly after that decision, it was looked at as a real foolish one. But certainly by the 1950s and 1960s, with the big money starting to come in from television, it really was ridiculous. And it was an exemption that no other professional sport enjoyed. Boxing and the theater establishment and football all had cases, antitrust cases, that went before the Supreme Court in the 50s, and they were all forced to comply with antitrust laws.
And I gather the reason that the law wasn't changed, or baseball's status wasn't changed vis-a-vis the antitrust laws, was Congress thought the courts should do it, the courts thought Congress should do it. Nobody kind of stepped up and did it.
Exactly. Everyone passed the buck. And I think that what baseball had in its favor is once they had that Supreme Court decision in their pocket, it's just very difficult for the Supreme Court to overturn one of its previous decisions, no matter how wrong-headed that decision may have been, and that's certainly what happened in the Flood case. Because when his case did make it to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court's ruling said, "Well, federal baseball, which was the name of the 22 decision, is an aberration. It's an anomaly, but we're not prepared to do anything about it. We'll just pass the buck on here to Congress."
Once Curt Flood had decided to challenge Major League Baseball, did he expect to win his case?
I think that he was very well prepared by Marvin Miller, the head of the union, that he really was going to lose, that the case was a real long shot to win in the courts. But Flood was undeterred, and I think that is because in order to really understand Flood, you have to really look at him as a player during the civil rights era, and was somebody who was very much shaped by that time. And he was a particularly conscientious and thoughtful person. He looked at the reserve clause as an extension of some of the injustices that he saw going around the country with the civil rights movement and with the war in Vietnam. And the real sacrifice for him would have been had he reported to Philadelphia and hadn't said anything about it. So even though he knew he was going to lose, he also knew in the process he would be able to raise the general awareness amongst baseball fans, amongst the media, all of whom had bought the line from the owners, that the owners had peddled forever, that without the reserve clause, baseball would be certainly ruined. And Flood was able to educate the public at large about just how unfair the reserve system was.
The owners, of course, alleged that without the reserve clause, as you say, baseball would be ruined because the competitive balance between the teams would be destroyed. Didn't anybody point out that the Yankees won the World Series every year in those days? Competitive balance was something of a myth anyway?
Yeah, well, Marvin Miller pointed that out during his first tour of spring training when Jim Boughton asked him, when he visited the Yankees, Jim Boughton asked him that same question, and Miller responded, "Well, what do you call what the Yankees have done over the last 25 years?" You know, when Flood came to the Players Association to get their support, one of the player reps, Tom Haller from the Los Angeles Dodgers, asked him, "You know, are you doing this? This is a black power gesture. Are you doing this because you're black?" And Flood said, "You know, I'm doing this for all players, period. However, my being black certainly makes me more sensitive." David Halberstam, you know, later said that, you know, the reserve system was a reminder to black players of what had happened to their ancestors in a way that it wouldn't be for a white player. I think Flood was able to see clear through those myths of the game that the owners projected all those years and was pretty bitter about it. So he had a lot of righteous indignation on his side.
Over the years since the late 60s, the Baseball Players Union has become the most powerful union in professional sports. But you point out that Curt Flood got very little support from active players while his suit was making its way through the courts. In 1970, when he was testifying in court, not a single player showed up to sit in the courtroom and support him. Why was that?
You know, it's interesting because I was able to look at the schedule of the local teams. The trial was in late May and early June of 1970, and the Yankees played several series in town, and the Mets played several series in town, and it just so happened that the Cardinals were one of those series against the Mets, and yet none of Flood's former teammates came to court. And I think it's really because at that period of time, the union was really in its early days. It hadn't been tested yet by a strike, so the sense of resolve really wasn't there when Flood, at the time of Flood's trial. Now, Flood did get financial support from the players' union, which was a big deal. That shouldn't be overlooked. At the same time, I think that, you know, Bob Gibson said, "Hey, listen, I'll be behind you, but I'm going to stand about 100 feet behind you because I don't want to get hit from any of the fallout." And I think that was a very real situation. It's easy, in a sense, to be backward-looking now and say, "Hey, listen, you know, if a half a dozen or a dozen of the biggest stars had come out in support of Flood, if Willie Stargell and Hank Aaron and a bunch of these guys had come to court, that really would have changed the results of the trial." I think Flood was left wondering that for years, and he had a certain amount of resentment towards his fellow ball players because they didn't show up for him. But to be honest with you, I don't think any kind of public show of support would have changed any of the results.
In 1975, 3 years after the Supreme Court heard Curt Flood's case and upheld the reserve clause, free agency was established by the ruling of an arbitrator in the cases of Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally. To what extent was the arbitrator's ruling informed by Flood's case?
Literally speaking, not at all. It had nothing to do with an antitrust, baseball's antitrust exemption. It had to do with the wording of what was considered the main part of the reserve clause in the player's contract. What Flood did do was, having put the inequities of the reserve clause on the front page, it just propelled the unions another step further, as did the strike of 1972. But literally speaking, Flood's case had nothing to do with the Messersmith-McNally ruling. What's ironic about it was that the Messersmith-McNally ruling was enabled by something that was agreed upon in the 1970 collective bargaining agreement, which was to get an impartial arbiter to determine situations. And Peter Seitz ended up becoming the impartial arbiter and judging on the Messersmith-McNally case. In the 1970 CBA, it was agreed that CBA was signed in May of 1970, the same month that Flood's case went to trial. So who knows, if Flood had been traded a year later, he probably would have been able to try the avenue that Miller eventually won in, which is the Messersmith-McNally case.
Certainly Marvin Miller, the longtime head of the Players Union, continued to remind players of Flood's contribution to their welfare while Miller was still on the job, but he's been retired for some years now. Do you think contemporary players have an appreciation for Curt Flood's importance?
I would definitely think that there are some players who are actively involved in the union, or older players like Curt Schilling and Mike Piazza, Tom Glavine, who are well aware of Curt Flood. But I would tend to doubt that a lot of the younger players know who Flood is. But that's the culture that we live in. People don't generally tend to remember what happened more than 5 minutes ago. And in Flood's case, Flood has been somebody, because really, I think because he lost his case, who has been slowly forgotten over a period of time. And though Flood is not properly remembered, he is certainly someone, particularly by the players, who deserves being remembered.
Alex Belth is the author of Stepping Up, the story of Curt Flood and his fight for baseball players' rights, published by Persia Books. He spoke with me from New York. Alex, thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
My conversation with Alex Belth will be featured on Saturday's program. We'll also have a story about traveling tennis players John McEnroe, Jim Courier, Todd Martin, and others who are shaking down the echoes on the courts of Sudbury, Massachusetts this week and weekend. We'll also have a story about the sports phenomenon that will give you almost 300,000 hits if you type it into Google. And if you guessed 2006 mock NFL draft, get a life. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to Only a Game at onlyagame.org.